philosophy and popular music. My guest today is Mr. Paul Beach, and I'm gonna cue up something right now to play.
It's solid gold in concert. Sweet as a punch. Sweet as a punch.
Paul, tell us what we just listened to. Are you there, Paul?
Right now? Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Well, I've got a bit of a scratchy throat, only because I've been singing so much this week. So we're going to have to bear with. But I brought you on the show because of your experiences with four different wildly successful pop bands in the 60s. That was one of them. That was the Association. You're going to tell us about your time with them, your time with Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, Spanking Our Gang, Mamas and Papas. But let's first talk about that audio we just heard.
That was the TV show we did back in, I think it was April of 1988, and at the ABC studios in Burbank with Solid Gold. It was called a Solid Gold in Concert series. It was, I think, one of the better shows that we did in terms of execution. Also, the production values in the show were really high. And the other people on the show were very interesting. Imagine my daughters, who were there taking a day off from school, playing hopscotch with Jack Russell, lead singer of Great White. you know, in between sound check and makeup and all that. That was a really solid lineup of personnel in the band, and I felt that we did a pretty credible performance on that.
Now, this audio was something all the current lineup was featured on that audio, as well as the video performance. Yeah.
Meaning current lineup, meaning the personnel.
I'm sorry, the lineup at the time was. Yeah. Tell us about the lineup at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, that was Larry Ramos and Russ Jagera and Jules Alexander. Jules handled the lead vocals, which he killed.
Yeah.
And he just nailed it in the studio. I think it was one take.
Wow.
And then he doubled it.
Yeah.
We had played together so much at that point that I remember it basically being one or two takes at the most in the studio.
Yeah.
And we had played it so much that the lip syncing part of it, if you didn't know it was recorded beforehand, you probably wouldn't be able to tell.
Yeah.
It was a strong band, and Bruce Pitcher, of course, the heartbeat of the band. He and I played together a lot, even previous to working with the Association. So we almost always seemed to be on the same page, and I was grateful for that, because as a bass player, that's just so critical to being able to do a good job, to have a good drummer.
Well, let's,
and Donnie Goujon on keyboards, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this era for you, these mm-hmm. four bands that you played with in succession, how this started, how the playing with each of these bands was related to each other. I'll let you start telling that story.
Okay. It all started with Gary Puckett. I was playing with a band that we had been doing a bunch of work in Vegas and some other places that was breaking up, as bands do happen to once in a while. And he knew Gary and knew that Gary was looking for a bass player. And we were doing our last gig in San Diego, the last gig we did as that band. His name was Steve Orr, very fine musician. He's still active here in San Diego County. And he said, why don't you go after the gig and go see Gary? They were going to be finishing up their show down at Anthony's Harborside, this big restaurant that had a nice showroom right down by the Star of India on the water there in the harbor in San Diego. And so I went down there, and the first person I see when I walk in, they had just finished up. Actually, I saw one song, and I took a look at that, and I went, oh my God, I would love to play in this band.
Mm-hmm.
But their bass player was leaving at the time, so they were looking for somebody to cover for him. After they got done playing, one of the band members came walking up to me, and I recognized him immediately. It was Brian Puckett. Gary's brother, and I knew him from, oh man, middle 70s maybe. He lived in the same general area that I did. And he said, what are you doing here? I said, well, heard you guys were looking for a bass player, and so I came down to check it out. And he goes, well, let me introduce you to Gary. And went through an extensive set of interviews and auditions. Long before I even played the first note on bass, Gary was checking out who I was as a human being. I could sing with him. Imagine this, sitting there in his place there in Cardiff and singing with the Gary Puckett, right?
Yeah.
Just doing it. He's sitting there playing guitar and singing with him. Just, it was kind of surreal.
Yeah.
And he was very gracious, and they shortly hired me, and I started with them in late 1981.
Okay.
And stayed with him through 1985.
Okay. And does that, is there a segue into our next act, or do you want to,
yes,
do it? We're coming up at about 15 on the hour, so I think Steve and I will do, my producer Steve Jones and I, is we'll do a little station identification, and we'll come back and play some Gary Puckett. Do you have a preference over, sure, which of these you've sent me you'd like me to play? I probably should have asked you this before we got on the air.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I think Lady Willpower really showcased.
Okay, great. Right. We're going to do some station identification. We'll come back with Lady Willpower.
Okay.
You're listening to Philosophy and Popular Music. I'm your host, Paul Wilson. Philosophy and Popular Music is sponsored in part by the Texas State University Department of Philosophy in affiliation with the Dialogue Series. Join the conversation. Okay, Paul, let's get back to your story.
All right, do you want the Cliff Notes version or the background story version?
I think what I could do is just play some stuff. Here's the answer to our problem here. I think I'm going to play the hits off of YouTube, and then when I have you back next year, we'll play some stuff that we couldn't play. This is Gary Puckett, Lady Willpower.
Here's our brand new tune, Lady Willpower.
Paul, did you realize that Gary said way of life instead of facts of life? I wonder if that was self-censoring, self-quarantining the risque language.
Yeah. I had no idea.
I couldn't tell what the performance was from, but it looked like it might have been Smothers Brothers. So unfortunately, Paul did send me some audio, but the player is not working on me. It's not only some of the live performances that he did with Gary and some of these other artists, but it's also a kind of a rare performance with the Gary Puckett Band. I'm going to have Paul back on my show some point in the near future so we can get some other stuff. But let's go on to talk about the Happy Together tour. How that gig with Gary was kind of a springboard for some of these other acts. Let's talk about that now, Paul.
Right. Well, actually, it goes back about a year before the Happy Together tour. Spanky McFarlane was singing with the Mamas and Papas,
mm-hmm,
at that point, and we did a lot of shows with them, including playing at the Copa Room in the Sands Hotel in Vegas, which was a really cool place because that's where the Rat Pack used to hang out and perform, and a lot of history in that building. And we did a double billing there with them, and then John decided to take a break from the band, and Spanky was looking for a gig, and I went to Gary and our road manager Jim Dotson, and suggested that we use our band to back her up if she was okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to clear it with them before we talked to her, and to kind of cut to the chase on it. She said yes, fine, and they hired me to do all the arranging, and direct the band, and we brought in a new keyboard player. David Puckett was in the band before that, and Gary's other brother. And we hired a guy by the name of Michael Peed out of San Diego, a very fine keyboard player. That was a very strong band. It was Paul Martin on guitar, Michael Peed on keyboards, and Brian on drums, and Gary also played piano and or guitar occasionally on for whatever it's called for. And that went so well that when we got the call to do the Happy Together tour, that he decided to include Spanky on the show. So the Happy Together tour went out in the spring of 1984. Originally was slated for about a 6-month run, if I remember right, and ended up adding a bunch of dates because we sold out everywhere we went. We were the second highest grossing tour that went out that year, and we were beat by Aerosmith that year, I believe.
Wow.
28 gold records between the four acts. Nothing but hits, and the entire show was about a 3-hour show, about a 30-minute admission for people to go buy merchandise and use the restroom or whatever. And it was a lot of fun.
Who were the four acts combined? So you essentially had Gary Puckett and Union Gap with that backing band, but that backing band was also doing Spankies. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah. Right. We were not called the Union Gap at that time, but it was Gary Puckett.
Yeah.
And Spanky, using all of us in Spanky's band, and then the other two acts were the Association and the Turtles.
All right.
And nobody wants to follow the Turtles.
Right. I've seen them a couple times now. They're hard act to follow. Yeah.
Yeah. It was always entertaining. And it was nice in the sense that it was a good clean show. It wasn't risque at all, particularly. We very often, in fact, most of the time, we saw three generations of people out there in the audience. It happened a lot. At first, we were a little surprised by it. But then after that, we just kind of got to expect it. And had a very warm reception. And the tour got extended to where we ended up being out about 9 months. And boy, we were working all the time. The routing at first was really nice. It was smooth. But then towards the end, when we were coming back to cities where we were sold out before, and then coming back for another show or other cities that got added on that we hadn't had before, the routing got crazy. And so sometimes, occasionally, we would fly to a date. Other than that, it was just really long drives. But by the time that tour was over, I think there was a universal sense of exhaustion in the band, but just a lot of elation too. We were really proud to have been a part of something that was so much fun and so good and so much good music.
Sure.
And there was about 35 of us on the tour, and the crew on that tour was amazing too. We couldn't have done that show without those guys. It was just smooth. It was a well-oiled machine, and all we had to do was show up and do our thing. And that was a great tour. I have a lot of good memories with that, and a lot of good friends for life as well.
Oh, wonderful. So, Paul, back now with Paul Beach, that was Give a Damn by Spanky and Our Gang. So, Paul, tell us about that song, performing that. Now, Spanky, the backing band for Gary and Spanky, there were no original Union Gap, no original Our Gang members in those lineups, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So tell us about performing the Spanky songs. What are your memories of that?
Well, first of all, it starts with Spanky herself. To me, she's like a force of nature. Just has this big personality and just this laugh that is so infectious. I consider her my big sister to this day.
Yeah.
You know, she kind of took me under her wing and showed me the ropes, because I was fairly new to the business back at that time, and I was very lucky to have people that showed me the way. And one of the best rules they taught me was keep your mouth shut and your eyes open.
I'm still learning that.
It kept me out of trouble sometimes.
Yeah, good, good.
Occasionally I couldn't help myself.
Sometimes,
pay the price for that.
Yeah.
But working with her was just so much fun. And she was so open to ideas about how to do things. And yet, at the very time, at the same time, had very strong opinions about how to do them. But I never felt awkward or uncomfortable working with her, ever. Hmm. And I think I could probably speak for the rest of the band and say they felt that way too.
Yeah, it was just something about the way she accommodated her staff. I mean, how would you explain the lack of not feeling awkward or uncomfortable? What would explain that environment, that good environment?
First of all, she looked at everybody as equal, and also, even more so, she had such tremendous respect for musicians.
Yeah.
And, you know, spoke the same language, was a true musician herself. And I don't remember us ever having any kind of disagreements, anything that amounted to anything.
Wow.
And it was, it was great.
Now, the next of these four bands you played with is the band that you and I have, of course, you had a tenure, but you and I have both played with the Association. Tell us about how the Association gig occurred. You met a lot of our mutual friends through that. What transpired between Spanky and the Association?
Well, it actually started in the middle, maybe a little bit later than the middle of the Happy Together tour in 84, mm-hmm. where three of the Association members left, Terry Kirkman, Ted Bluchel, and Rick Olsky. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they were really trying to figure out what to do.
Jim had already left before the, I guess, the Happy Together stuff. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
I had met him a couple of times. It was before I was even a professional musician, honestly. It was when the band first got together way back in the day. And actually, there was a couple of shows they did, too, in New York. I forgot when I was working with Gary, and I saw them there as well at the Nassau Coliseum and also at the Meadowlands. And those guys were so good, man. At that time, they were actually thinking of leaving the tour, and Michael Pete and I, our keyboard player, were sitting there talking about the fact that they really needed only a couple of key components to be able to stay on tour. So we floated the idea again with Gary and our road manager Jim Dotson, and before we approached the Association, and then Gary and Jim Dotson and Michael Pete and myself, they could probably remember this better than I do, but this is the way I remember it. We had a meeting with the remaining guys on the tour, and that would have been Larry and Jules, actually, and I don't think the other band members were there, and floated the idea to them, and they said, well, let us get back to you, give us 24 hours, and this was about a week before everybody left. And we had a break coming up right after they were going to leave, mm-hmm. of about, I think, 7 days or something. And they liked the idea. It worked financially for them. It worked musically, and it worked financially for us. So Michael took over the keys, mm-hmm. From Rick Olsky. And they needed another voice, so I sang. Joel Amano was still there playing bass.
Okay.
And so they didn't need a bass player. And the first time we sang together after the break on stage, it was really interesting because the rest of the musicians on the tour were really curious how it was going to turn out. So behind us, it was at Colorado Springs at their theater. I can't think of the name of it right now. But anyway, it was Colorado Springs, and everybody was behind us, you know, peeking out from behind curtains and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we thought, well, if they're happy, we'll be happy.
Yeah.
And we had a couple one rehearsal in Orange County at the Coach House, which is the concert club in San Juan Capistrano, close to where Larry lived at the time. Mm-hmm. And the rehearsals went well, and so everybody decided, okay, got the green light on this, went ahead with it. And I don't think any of us were nervous about it particularly, because we knew it was going to work.
Yeah.
And everybody else just needed to hear it. And so we performed with them for the rest of the tour. Then after the tour, the bass player from the Turtles, Michael Visseglia, got a call from that artist. She did My Name is Luca.
Suzanne Vega.
And yeah. Suzanne Vega, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Senior moment, sorry.
No, it's okay.
And so he left the Turtles. Turtles were looking for a bass player, so they hired Joe Lomano. And then at that point, the association was looking for a bass player, so they called me. And Gary decided he was going to take a break
from the business for a while. So it all worked out.
But yeah, it's like a big game of musical chairs,
that's
if
right.
you will.
So at that
and
yeah,
and so I knew I already knew their show from the Happy Together tour, which didn't include their full show by themselves, but. The bass players and I got together from the other bands, and we learned each other's shows in case of any family emergencies
right.
or anything that would pull anybody off the tour. And the other musicians did the same thing. So during the association's tour, I already knew a bunch of their material on bass, and having sung with them for half the tour, I knew those songs on vocals. So I ended up learning the rest of them. And at that point, they were also looking for a drummer because Brian was retiring from the business and wanted to spend more time with his family. And so we did a cattle call for the drummers.
Wow.
And yeah, one after another over at Donnie's house in Burbank. And I thought, you know, Bruce Pitcher would be just perfect for this. First of all, Bruce Pitcher was a huge fan of Hal Blaine, which is a big plus.
Right, right.
Because he was on the original recordings from
sure.
the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
And so I asked Bruce if he would be interested if in an auditioning if the guy decided they wanted to see him. And he goes, absolutely. And he goes, what do you think they'd be looking for? I said, learn the records the way they were originally recorded. I said, then and, you know, then if we make any changes, you can go from there. I said, but I think that's crucial.
Yeah.
So I mentioned his name to the guys, and he said, yeah, have him come in. And I think he did one song, maybe two songs. And the guys were looking at each other, and they went, yeah, this is the guy. there was no question. And I'm nervous because I don't want to sell Bruce at that point, because I'm the one that brought him in.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was up to him to sell himself at that point. But I'm just getting all excited going, yep, this is it. This is the guy.
Great.
They don't hire this guy. I don't know what we're going to do. But, yeah, and he's still with them to this day.
He still is. Yeah. And he's definitely among the very, very best drummers I've played with. And I know you feel the same way. So.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the best human beings
absolutely.
I've met, too.
We love
and,
Bruce.
Yeah, absolutely. And Linda, too, because they're a team. You don't deal with Bruce without dealing with Linda.
Yeah. Well,
Go ahead. No, I'm just saying that I was a really happy camper when they decided to hire him, because I really, really wanted him to be on board. And, of course, I couldn't express that at the time.
Right.
Because, you know, if you sell too hard, everybody's going to get skeptical. So I just kept my mouth shut, which, you know, for me is pretty difficult.
And we are back. This is my fifth episode of Philosophy and Popular Music. I have called this episode Beach, Bass, and the Four Bands, which means we've been talking to my good friend Paul Beach. We've been talking about his career as a bass player with four just iconic bands of the 1960s. Now, Paul, I want you to tell us a few things here toward the end. We're going to talk a little bit about your stint with the Mamas and Papas. I think what's interesting is that even though you were involved in choir and you had a very musical background, you didn't really start playing the bass until sort of later than most young men would probably. And I'd like just to talk about that stuff as well as give us just sort of your philosophy on the business based on your early experiences with these four bands.
Well, first of all, everybody, you're listening to the smooth, dulcet, husky tones of Paul Wilson.
Yeah, I've got a voice for radio. I sure do.
It's
getting worse, isn't it? Yeah, this is
right.
just strange singing voice. I feel great. I don't have any kind of contagious pandemic thingy or other. Go ahead, Paul. Yeah.
I thank everybody. Good night.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The show must go on. That's why I'm here, man.
That's
show
right.
must go on. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're doing fine, man. Don't
no,
worry
I'm
about
not.
it. Both of my parents were musicians.
Yeah.
And I actually ended up taking music theory and composition from my dad in college. And they listened to a lot of music, almost all classical music, because they had a pretty high standards about what they wanted to hear in the household in terms of their spiritual beliefs and whatnot. And also, I sang in boys' choir at the same time from the age of about 9 to 14 when my voice changed, maybe earlier than 14, actually. And the leader of that was a guy by the name of Doug Neslin, who's also down there in Texas your way these days. And he ended up turning that boys' choir into an international act. In fact, when I first sang with him, the second year I was with him, we did some light touring with as an opening act for the Vienna Choir Boys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, it was a high standard to meet, to be on the same stage with those kids.
Yeah.
And so I started in vocals early. One of the things that happens when you're in a boys choir is that you develop that higher register, and when you get older and your voice changes, you still have some of that muscle memory, maybe a lot of it,
right,
to where you can hit the falsetto pretty easily, which came into really good use later on, especially singing with the association.
Yeah, sure.
And we would have fun with switching parts around and stuff as kids, because, you know, we couldn't sit still for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And sang with vocal groups all the way up through college. I was a music major in college.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I think I had a really good foundation and fundamental training with what I ended up doing later. And I would, you know, I even though I, from the time I turned professional full-time in music to the time I started working Gary with Puckett was only about 18 months.
Right.
That's a pretty fast turnaround, but I think you have to really look at it in the perspective of, you know, my training for that went all the way back to when I was little. So,
sure.
You know, 20-some years at least, you know, leading up to that point. So putting in that context, it makes more sense. Doesn't seem like it's quite as fast.
Yeah.
At the time, it seemed like it took forever for me, you know, because I was impatient. But I lived in Carlsbad, California at the time on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And my neighbor across the street, this guy by the name of Tom Morey, who incidentally was the guy that invented the Morey boogie board.
Oh, wow.
I know, huh? He introduced me to a bunch of musicians, one of them being one of our neighbors down the street, a guy by the name of Terry Paul. At that time, Terry was the bass player for Kris Kristofferson.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing in bands in Carlsbad, in the surrounding area in San Diego County, and wanted to do it full time, didn't know how to do it, so I started picking Terry's brain, and one day he decided to take me seriously. I kept nagging him. And the first piece of advice he gave me, leading into the philosophy of being in the business, was, Paul, you got to understand this one thing. If you don't understand this one thing, don't even try.
Okay.
Pick something else to do with your life. He said, the business of music is primarily about relationships. He says, you got to be able to hang with people. You got to treat them right, and they will treat you right.
Yeah.
Of course, you got to bring your skills to the table, and there is a standard for which you have to meet that. But the other is far more important. If you don't know something, don't try to pretend that you know it. Just be yourself. Don't try to be anything else. And that came into really good stead when I first started going out on the road with Gary.
Yeah.
And especially later with the Turtles. I learned a lot from the Turtles, like how light to pack. I was carrying way too much stuff at the beginning of that tour. And I saw these guys walking around with a gig bag and maybe a backpack and then a clothing bag.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, man, I can't do that. But I learned pretty quickly that actually works much better.
Right.
So things like Terry, one of the other things he told me was when you do start getting out there in the road, he goes, I think you'd be able to do it. He says, when you do, remember this, always have enough money in the bank to be able to get home from anywhere in the world if the gig blows up on you.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Boy, was that true. I got my baptism and fired up pretty early on. Yeah, I found out the hard way. And he had a lot of other advice, too, about how to prepare, exercises to do, both physically and also on your instrument and vocally. And then how to prepare yourself emotionally, go on stage, you know, how to beat the butterflies. And he did kind of a meditation thing he did before going on stage, basically controlling your breathing and slowing your heart rate down and focusing on that. So by the time you hit the stage, you were clear and you weren't all amped up and nervous and making mistakes because of it. I could go on and on and on about the thing before, but they really came into play and helped me so immensely. And to this day, I consider him my mentor. In fact, on the first tour I did with Mamas and Papas, our first gig was in Honolulu, Hawaii. And that's where he was living at the time. Mm-hmm. And he came to the gig. And after thousands of shows, seeing him out in the audience, it was like my dad was in the audience or something. I was so nervous.
Wow.
I was watching every single note. I didn't want to look out in the audience or anything. I just wanted to concentrate, make sure I did a good job. He also was real big on less is more. And Terry not only played with Chris all those years, but he also is on records with Bob Dylan and some other artists. I think one of them is Lay Lady Lay.
Oh, wow.
And we're Knocking on Heaven's Door. He might be on both of those. I think it's Knocking on Heaven's Door for sure he's on. But he was hired for his ability to play really clean musical lines, and he played to the song. That was the other biggest thing he taught me.
Song, yeah.
It was to serve the song. He says, don't get in the way of the song. And Gary was a big help with that, too. Our first rehearsal together with Gary, and when I started playing with Bruce, he stopped us in mid-song, and he goes, okay, you guys, to both of us. He goes, what you're playing, cut it in half. And then he stopped us again. Cut it in half again. And we're Bruce and I are looking at each other. We need all those notes. And, he had us cut in half again. And then eventually the lights came on and bells started ringing with both of us. And then Bruce and I would spend hours just working on grooves and subtleties and how to lay a beat down behind the beat, on top of the beat, in the middle of the beat, how to space the bass, release notes with what he was doing between his hi-hat and his snare and working with the kick and attack and release, not just, hitting a note right.
Right.
And I learned to be more of a musical interpreter playing bass because of that. It's extremely helpful. I've had so many people that gave me good advice along the way that I'm more grateful to them than I am the God-given talent that I have. That's only a tool that God gives you, and then it's up to you to develop it, because it doesn't matter how much talent you have. I mean, it doesn't matter how much skill you have. It's the talent that counts, and the skill will come. Yeah. And skill is not always what you think it is. It's not playing flashy technical stuff necessarily. It's being musical and being able to hear everybody else and work with them and be on the same page. It's a little bit like surfing, finding that sweet spot on the wave and just staying there as long as you can.
Paul, thank you so much for being my guest this afternoon. I'm going to send this out of the hour with another song, Mamas and Papas, California Dreamin'. Thanks again, my friend, and I'll be talking to you here real soon.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your efforts on all of us, our behalf, and in keeping 60s music alive with as many people as we can, because it was a real important era in our musical history, I think.
Thanks, amigo. I'll talk to you soon, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye.